The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So what on earth is the district court supposed to do on remand? Does it rule on the lawfulness of surveillance as required by 1806F? Or does it dismiss the claim as the government seeks to have it do under the state secrets privilege? Now, in most cases where the relevant agency isn't the Department of Justice, the government is going to resolve this conflict by picking which approach it wants to take. Is it going to submit a declaration from the head of the agency claiming state secrets, or is it going to file an affidavit from the attorney general talking about national security harm? And in a civil lawsuit, it will pick the state secrets privilege every time because it can get the evidence and possibly even the whole lawsuit thrown out without any determination of the lawfulness of surveillance. So in practice, what the court was holding, even though it didn't say so, is that the state secrets privilege displaces 1806F. And that's just not how it's supposed to work. When a statute comes into conflict with the common law, in the hierarchy of legal authorities, the statute should prevail.
I'm Rukini Kurup, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 25th, 2022. Earlier this month, the Supreme Court issued rulings in two separate cases involving the state secrets privilege, United States versus Abu Zubaydah and FBI versus Fezaga. To talk about the court's decision and what it means for state secrets doctrine and executive power, we brought back to the podcast Liza Goitein, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and Bob Loeb, partner in Orrick, Herrington & Sutcliffe's Supreme Court and appellate litigation practice, and former acting deputy director of the Civil Division appellate staff at the Department of Justice. I first talked to them on the Lawfare podcast back in October, when we discussed the cases that were then before the court. Now that the court has issued its ruling, I brought them back to talk about the court's decision and what it means for the future of state secrets doctrine. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 25th, the Supreme Court rules on state secrets. So before we get into the court's ruling and the two cases and what it all means, I'd like to take a step back and first talk about the cases themselves. The court heard United States versus Abu Zubaydah in October and decided in that case a day before it did in FBI versus Fezaga. Bob, you've written about the Abu Zubaydah case for Lawfare, among other places. Can you get us up to speed here? What was that case about, and how does the issue of state secrets play a role in that case?
Sure. So the case, so background involves Abu Zubaydah, who is an alleged senior al-Qaeda official, associate of bin Laden. And it's not disputed that he was captured in Pakistan in 2002 and that he was detained outside the United States at several black sites in foreign countries, and then was ultimately moved to Guantanamo, where he remains today. So this case is one where Abu Zubaydah is trying to get Poland to prosecute Polish officials for his mistreatment there. He thinks that one of the black sites where he was kept was in Poland, and wants there to be people to be held accountable, those Polish officials to be accountable. So Poland asked for information from the U.S. government under a treaty, the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, and the U.S. government denied that request. Now here, Abu Zubaydah is trying to seek similar information directly himself in U.S. courts under a provision, section 1782, subsection A, which allows you to get discovery in U.S. courts for litigation in other countries. And he sought information from two of the individuals who were involved in the enhanced interrogation program, and who interrogated Abu Zubaydah, and their treatment of him has most of that has been made public, and including these two individuals' involvement with it. And so he's trying to get information from them about how he was treated, but mostly, as the government argued, what they want is confirmation that he was held in Poland. So the government stepped in and said, look, if you, the court, grant this request, you're basically confirming that he was held in Poland, because the only reason his interrogator's information would be relevant is because this is a proceeding in Poland regarding holding Polish officials responsible. The only reason that would be relevant is if this, in fact, was in Poland. And the U.S. government says, look, where the black sites is still an official secret. And we have given our assurances to the countries that were involved that we wouldn't disclose what countries were assisting us and where those black sites were. And even though people have speculation and other people have said it's Poland, we are not officially confirming anything. And our partners expect us to keep this secret. And so they invoked the state secrets privilege, saying this action should be denied. And so this went up to the district court and the court of appeals and ultimately into the Supreme Court that was argued in the fall. And there was a decision on March 3rd, where the court agreed with the U.S. government that the state secrets privilege was properly invoked.
We'll talk about the opinion in a bit, but maybe if you can talk about the oral arguments themselves and what the lawyers for Zubaydah and the government argued before the court and some of the interactions with the justices.
Sure. So there was a lot of speculation about this case because the Supreme Court hadn't taken up a state secrets case in a long time. And the underpinnings of the doctrine have always been debated. And now we have an originalist, textualist court. And this is a doctrine which the courts have pretty much made up. So it wasn't clear, you know, how this was going to come out. But it was clear then from oral argument, at least to me, that the court was taking the state secrets doctrine as a given and that it was taking it very seriously and was going to hold that the material here was protected, at least a majority of the court was going to say it was protected from disclosure. So first at oral argument, the U.S. government, the Solicitor General, Brian Fletcher, argued defending the assertion. And, you know, and there was some skepticism at some point, you know, information is so known in the public, can it really be held to be a secret still? And Justice Breyer pushed back on that, and Justice Kagan pushed back on that. But ultimately, it seemed that it was just a question of, you know, how much deference the court would give to the government on this. And ultimately, you have the head of the CIA under one administration, and then continuing under the current administration, the Biden administration, saying this remains to be a secret, right? And that Poland and the other, you know, or whatever other country it is involved, that they expect us to maintain our promises of secrecy. Now, the counsel for Abu Zubaydah, David Klein, he started his argument saying, look, we're not planning to ask these contractors who did the interrogations if their conduct took place in Poland. We're just asking them what happened and the details of it. And so all this business about the location is just a red herring. But he got a lot of pushback from Justice Thomas and from Justice Barrett and Kagan on that, saying, look, the only reason this is relevant is to a Polish proceeding is if it occurred in Poland. So don't try to pull the wool over our eyes. This is all about whether it occurred in Poland or not. Moreover, what happened with the interrogations, that's been mostly declassified, and there's been great detail about that. So there wasn't, you know, a overwhelming need for it in the views of a number of the justices. The one, you know, surprise at argument was Justice Gorsuch started with an inquiry as whether the government had waived the state secret privilege by releasing so much information on the subject of the conditions of confinement and the interrogation. And was the government just doing this to hide information about its torture, trying to protect itself improperly, you know, from its illegal conduct? And then sort of got on a tangent that they're preventing the lawyers from talking to Abu Zubaydah and getting information from Abu Zubaydah himself about how the interrogations were conducted. And that led to a letter being submitted afterwards by the Solicitor General in responding to some of the questions from Justice Gorsuch, confirming that, in fact, the counsel is, you know, have been given clearances and talked to Abu Zubaydah on a regular basis, and that he can provide them information, and that information can be made public as long as it goes through the existing screening mechanism that is set up through the military court down there. And that they weren't trying to invoke state secrets here to prevent information regarding his treatment from being withheld from the public. So, you know, from the argument itself, it seemed like the only ones who were really hostile to the government's position were Justice Gorsuch and Justice Sotomayor. And Justice Gorsuch seemed to be sort of just misperceiving the lay of the land as far as the information that was available to counsel and the information that was available to the public regarding his treatment already being out there.
If I could jump in just on that point, I wouldn't say that Justice Gorsuch's questions on that, those topics were a tangent or that he was misreading the lay of the land, because first of all, the issue of whether or not the government was actually trying to just cover up evidence of torture is obviously relevant to whether the state secrets privilege is being properly invoked. The government itself, Department of Justice, has a policy saying that they cannot invoke the state secrets privilege in order to simply shield themselves from embarrassment. So that's a relevant inquiry in the first place. But then the specific issue of whether Zubaydah would be able to somehow make his treatment public in some other way through his lawyers and through a written testimony, that's quite relevant because, as it turns out in the opinion, several justices held that the state secrets privilege should be respected in part because Zubaydah did not have a great need for the information. And one of the reasons certainly that Justices Thomas and Alito cited was the fact that he could have simply just explained publicly what his treatment was. And in order for that to be true, he needs to be able to speak to his lawyers, yes, but he also needs to be able to provide public written testimony. And it is far from clear that that will ever happen, that his testimony will ever see the light of day if he goes that route, because, of course, the same government officials who interposed the state secrets privilege here will be the ones who will be reviewing his testimony to see whether it can be made public. So I think this was quite a relevant line of inquiry and played a significant part in the opinions on both sides.
Liza, let's turn to the other case now, FBI versus Fazaga. Before we get into the opinion in the Zubaydah case, so the Supreme Court heard Fazaga in November. Tell us what that case was about and what the state secrets question was there.
The question in that case is whether a provision of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act displaces the common law state secrets privilege to the extent that it requires courts to deal with state secrets in a different way than they might if they were proceeding under the common law. The lawsuit was brought by three Muslim Americans who alleged that the FBI paid a confidential informant to conduct a covert surveillance program in Southern California, known as Operation Flex, that gathered information about Muslims based solely on their religious identity. Those were the allegations. The government asserted the state secrets privilege over certain categories of information and moved to dismiss some of the plaintiff's claims on that basis. The plaintiffs argued that dismissal under the state secrets privilege was improper because FISA establishes a different way to deal with purported state secrets, which is set forth in 50 U.S.C. 1806F. And in particular, if the government asserts that the disclosure of materials relating to FISA surveillance would harm national security, the court must review the materials ex parte and in camera and must determine whether the surveillance was lawful. The government argued, among other things, that this provision of FISA did not apply to this type of civil lawsuit and this particular posture of the state secrets privilege, where the government sought to dismiss certain claims based on the privilege, that in essence, it only applied essentially when the non-government party was seeking to suppress evidence, essentially, that the government wanted to introduce. The district court held that this provision of FISA only applied to, in terms of civil lawsuits, to challenges to FISA, not to civil lawsuits brought on other grounds. The Ninth Circuit reversed. It held that the plain terms of Section 1806F and the history and the purpose of FISA require that the 1806F mechanism be used, be available in any case involving an attempt either to obtain or suppress FISA materials so that it would apply in this case. Interestingly, the Supreme Court opinion took an extremely different tack than I would have expected from the oral argument. And instead of resolving the question of whether Section 1806F applied in this case, the court just assumed that it did apply, but then it ruled that Section 1806F and the state secrets privilege address entirely different things and therefore are, you know, mutually can coexist and one does not displace the other, which, you know, I'm sure we'll get to this in the discussion, is a really, really weird decision and makes extremely little sense. So the court held that the 1806F does not displace the state secrets privilege. What flows from that, frankly, is a little bit confusing in this context, but that was the ruling.
And Liza, what arguments did both sides make before the Supreme Court and how did the justices seem to respond to those arguments during oral argument?
Yeah, I mean, the arguments were very much focused on the correct interpretation of 1806F and whether that provision of FISA actually applies to this lawsuit. What is the scope of that provision of 1806F, which ultimately was not the question that the court addressed? And, you know, there were arguments based on the text. Those arguments seemed to go pretty strongly in the plaintiff's favor. But there were other arguments based on structure. There were some structural arguments that the plaintiffs made, some structural arguments that the government made. You know, different justices tipped their hands in terms of what they thought was stronger. Then at some point, given the admitted difficulty of some of these questions of interpretation over 1806F, there seemed to be a movement among some of the justices to just punt the issue entirely and instead send back to the Ninth Circuit to rule on the issue of whether the state secrets privilege actually even applies and whether, if so, it would require dismissal of the claims. The theory being, hey, if the state secrets privilege doesn't even apply or can't result in dismissal, then maybe we don't need to, well, if it doesn't apply, maybe we don't need to resolve whether 1806F displaces it or not. And so for a minute, it seemed like that's the way they were going to rule. That's what I got out of the argument in any case.
So fast forward to the beginning of March 2022, this month, the court issued rulings in both of the cases. Bob, can you walk us through the majority opinion in Zubeda, which you touched on a bit already? So that opinion written by Breyer for a very fractured court and some of the concurrences that we also saw.
So it was fractured, but there's a pretty large, there's six justice majority who agreed in the dismissal of the claims based on state secrets. You know, some just have slightly different approaches to the state secrets and how it works, but all of the six agreed. That however the test was framed and whatever analytically it should be approached, that here the state secrets is properly invoked. So Justice Breyer's opinion is pretty straightforward. He says that state secrets can be invoked as a privilege, doesn't have to decide what the background of it is or the basis of it is, if the government can show there's a reasonable likelihood of harm to national security, and that's without the court even looking at the information at all. And he stresses that the courts are ill-equipped and really should be reluctant to second guess the executive when you have a sworn affidavit from the head of the CIA and from the Attorney General explaining that this is would likely harm national security. Then it goes on to explain, you know, how much the court should probe the executive's reasoning. And they say, well, the court, of course, should consider whether there's countervailing interests. And they say, Justice Breyer says, where there's a showing of necessity from the party seeking the information and the disclosure, here off of Zubeda, that if there is a significant showing of necessity, then the scrutiny that the court should give at the next step will be higher. But if you can't make that showing of necessity, then it basically suggests that, you know, the case is over or that the state secrets invocation is then correct.
And how about the dissent written by Justice Gorsuch and joined by Justice Sotomayor? How did they push back on the majority's argument?
So the dissent of Gorsuch and Sotomayor pushed back in saying this approach the majority took gives too much deference to the executive branch. And they detail how in the past, the state secrets privilege was invoked where it was really just covering up misdeeds by either the executive branch or a government contractor. They point to some of the key cases that are relied on for the state secrets doctrine, saying ultimately those were not, you know, properly invoked in those cases, and that a court should come with a strong degree of skepticism to the state secrets privilege. And here they point to how much information is already out there in the public about the interrogations, how much already has been out there in the public suggesting that this has occurred in Poland, including a statement from the prior president, former president of Poland, who's not speaking officially on behalf of Poland, but, you know, they find his statement, you know, very probative evidence that it was Poland since he said so. You know, he starts out his opinion. There's a point where judges shouldn't be, you know, ignorant as to what we know as true citizens and shouldn't just allow the government to invoke state secrets when we know it's really, there's no basis for it as a factual matter. So as far as the six justices who were in favor of dismissal, and even Justice Kagan, who would just remand, they all were giving large degrees of deference to the invocation of state secrets as to the location of the black site here, even though there's a lot in the public domain suggesting that's in Poland, and giving deference to the assertion that this is going to be harmful to the relations with other people in the intelligence community. And basically, Justice Gorsuch is almost applying a de novo, no deference or very little deference approach to that, especially where there's enough information in the public domain to be skeptical about it. How exactly all this would work under the views of Justice Gorsuch and Sotomayor isn't entirely clear, but it's clear that in this particular case, with the amount of information that's already out there, they were highly skeptical that this was an appropriate invocation. And they do, as Liza suggests, raise the flag here that the executive and the intelligence community is really just trying to keep information from the public about this chapter in U.S. history about abuse of the detainees, and that that's not an appropriate invocation of the state secrets privilege to do so, and that the courts shouldn't be party to that.
I would add that I think Justice Gorsuch and Justice Sotomayor did basically articulate a way that the court should proceed in looking at state secrets privilege assertions that was similar to what Justice Breyer put forward in his opinion for the majority or the plurality, depending on the part of the opinion. But essentially what Justice Gorsuch said is, you know, at the first stage, the government has to make an assertion that meets the straight face test. If it meets the straight face test, then we go, he didn't use those words, but that's, you know, it has to meet a certain minimal threshold of plausibility. Then we go to the necessity question. Does the non-government party really need the information? And that determines how much we will probe beyond that sort of surface level. But what Justice Gorsuch said, I wouldn't say that he showed no deference. I think what he said is, we're not even past the straight face test here because we have the former president of Poland. We have the European Court of Human Rights concluding beyond a reasonable doubt that there was a black site in Poland. And you know, the U.S. government doesn't have a lock on the truth. There are other ways of establishing reality. And in a situation where no reasonable person could have any doubt on this question, then, you know, then no foreign intelligence service could possibly take the position that the United States had betrayed a confidence, because there's no confidence left to betray. So I do think that Justice Gorsuch did not suggest that there should be no deference or that it should be a purely de novo review. But I think he and Justice Sotomayor felt in this case that even this really minimal showing of plausibility for the privilege just wasn't there.
Yeah, so the six justices who voted for dismissal, and even Justice Kagan, really seven, based on the question of location, all agreed that the showing by the government, the initial showing by the government of a reasonable likelihood of harm to national security was met. Now, Justice Gorsuch, in his opinion, comes back and says, well, all they did was just say that in their declaration. They said, look, we've told these other countries and their intelligence communities that we would keep the location secret, and they haven't agreed to it being disclosed, and we're going to keep our promise. And breaking that promise would cause harm to national security because they won't trust us going forward. So seven justices said, that's good enough for us. And Justice Gorsuch says, that's just their say-so. I mean, they're just saying that. Who's to show and say that's actually true? And it's not clear how a court would actually make that assessment. You know, you can make your independent assessment. It's like, well, there's so much information out there. It's not plausible that this other country's intelligence community or the leadership of that country actually cares. And now we have the official U.S. government saying they still do care and it would disrupt relations going forward. And I think what this opinion shows that you have still a large majority of the court, which is not going to second guess the executive, even on those kinds of assessments, even if they seem to you and me and to Justice Gorsuch as being a little bit, you know, you're skeptical as to whether that's the reality. Ultimately, they viewed that's an area of relations between intelligence communities and foreign governments. And you have two different administrations coming in and telling us it's true. Who are we to second guess them about that?
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten eight others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
I would have liked to see an additional point raised in the dissent. It's one thing to say that in general, we want foreign intelligence services to cooperate with U.S. intelligence services. It's a very different matter to say that we want foreign intelligence services to assist U.S. intelligence services in committing war crimes. I don't think that is in the national security of the United States. I'd be very comfortable with a rule that says foreign intelligence agencies in general can rely on the United States to keep their relationship confidential, assuming that it hasn't already been made public in a way that leaves no doubt, as in this case, but that foreign intelligence services cannot rely on the confidentiality of agreements to commit torture. You know, something roughly analogous to the crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege. Yes, we want clients to be able to trust their attorneys, but that ends at the point where clients are using their attorneys to commit a crime. This was not an argument that was advanced in the case, but I sort of wish that someone had made that point.
I think that's a good point. I think another observation about the Supreme Court's opinion is that not only we have these seven justices showing this great deference to the executive on the state secret privilege being invoked, but you have Justices Thomas and Alito write a separate opinion being even more deferential, saying that unless the person seeking the information shows that strong necessity for the information at the outset, you know, it's over just because the government has invoked a privilege without any even inquiry into whether it's a reasonable likelihood of harm to national security. They would just put the first step to be that it's on the person seeking information to show the strong necessity. And here, I think all the justices other than the dissenters found that there wasn't a showing of that strong necessity. So Justices Alito and Thomas would end inquiry there. And Justice Kavanaugh and Barrett wrote a separate opinion written by Justice Kavanaugh, also being even more deferential, I think, than Justice Breyer in how they would make an assessment about whether there is a reasonable possibility of harm to national security and how you would weigh the interests of the party seeking the information. Even though there's a strong dissent by Gorsuch, and it's clear that going forward, he has some skepticism of deference to the executive on some of these matters and on state secrets privilege, there still seems to be a very strong supermajority of the court, which has an ongoing both embracement of the state secrets privilege and an ongoing showing of just strong deference to the executive when they say this is going to harm our relationship with another country or in their intelligence services, that they're just unwilling to dig much deeper on that, even though there's some language in the opinion here saying that, you know, once the other side shows a compelling need, then you do that. The overarching, I think, tenor of the opinion here is that, you know, courts really just aren't suitable for making those determinations.
I would agree with that. But in that regard, I think Justice Gorsuch's dissent made a very important point that I think too few courts have recognized, that all three branches of government have constitutional equities at stake when the executive branch asserts the state secrets privilege. The executive branch has the duty and the prerogative of protecting national security information. Congress has the duty and prerogative to authorize lawsuits. And the judiciary has the duty and prerogative to resolve cases and controversies. And so, Justice Gorsuch basically said, you know, when the executive branch seeks to withhold evidence, thanks to the powers it enjoys under Article 2, and these are his words, that claim must be carefully assessed against the competing powers Articles 1 and 3 have vested in the Congress and the judiciary. And I would like to see, you know, more attention paid to those other constitutional interests, which simply weren't addressed by the other justices.
Bob, as you mentioned a little earlier, after oral argument in this case and in response to questions from the justices, the Justice Department told the court that Zubeda could send a declaration to authorities in Poland that could include details about his torture by the CIA. How much did that matter to the court's ruling here? And to the extent that it did matter at all, should it have factored into the legal question about the proper bounds of state secrets?
I think it factored in because it sort of just answered the line of questions that Justice Gorsuch was making at argument, suggesting that the government here was trying to cover up, you know, what occurred during the enhanced interrogation / torture of Zubeda. And the assumption that were being articulated by Justice Gorsuch that they were somehow thwarting that information from getting out, and the fact that the government could diffuse that and show that, in fact, they do allow the lawyers to meet with him, and they, to the extent he has a statement, he can get that cleared, you know, through proper channels, like, which is an ongoing process through the military commission and otherwise in the habeas cases to be produced. So I think it's cited in the opinion a couple places, more in just sort of response to the concerns that were raised by Justice Gorsuch at argument to that what's going on here is not a cover up of the mistreatment of Zubeda, but instead very limited to trying to keep the promise to the foreign government and to its intelligence community that that its cooperation would remain an official secret until they, otherwise agreed to have it disclosed, which according to the U.S. government, they haven't done. So I don't think it was a driving force of the opinions here as much as it was just to take that issue off the table. I don't think it convinced Justice Kagan, because she would still remand to the Ninth Circuit to see if we could still get more information about his treatment and get it sort of separated from the question of where it occurred, and that information could still be disclosed and there could still be further interviews with the two contractors. But to short answer your question, I don't think it was a major, factor here. And I don't even think it ended up being a major factor in the Gorsuch dissent either, that it mostly took it off, that aspect of it off the table.
Liza, any thoughts on that?
I would agree that it probably wasn't as major a factor. I mean, Justices Thomas and Alito said that was it. That was the whole ball game, essentially. So, but if you leave them aside, the other justice and Justices Alito and Thomas had three distinct reasons why Zubeda did not need this information, and one of them was this, that he could have sought to do public testimony on his own and didn't, and so that meant that it wasn't necessary. The other reasons were a little. I mean, one of them was pretty much pure xenophobia, which is that there's no need to give testimony in a foreign trial. Essentially, no plaintiff has it, or no party has a need to provide information in a foreign proceeding. Well, Congress has said otherwise, right? I mean, that's the statute at issue, is Congress saying, yeah, people in this country can and should in certain circumstances make that evidence available. But anyway, looking at the other justices, yeah, it played probably did not play as much as a role as their initial assessment of the credibility or the viability of the government's state secrets claim in the first instance. It was disheartening to see how willing some of the justices were to rely on this representation by the government that there was another way for Zubeda to make his treatment public through this process of getting his testimony cleared internally. There's a long record of the government not allowing Guantanamo detainees to speak publicly about their torture. That has been the norm. And that this process of internal review has resulted in all of this information being suppressed. So the notion that somehow Zubeda's testimony is going to sail through this process in some way does not make a lot of sense.
So Liza, I don't think it was only Zubeda's testimony was going to serve that need. That I think the majority of the justices also all cited the fact that we have the same contractors that Zubeda is trying to interview here have already provided interviews in great detail about what they've done and the misdeeds that occurred. and that we have a lengthy congressional investigation and with volumes and volumes of details of hundreds of pages where we know details about the waterboarding and walling and sleep deprivation. So there's been an extraordinary amount of what was previously held to be, you know, code word, top secret classified information has been declassified, or about his treatment and treatment of a number of the other detainees of both, you know, at the black sites, et cetera.
Yeah, I agree. And that was a separate reason why the justices felt that Zubaydah had not shown a strong necessity. One of the reasons was because he could offer testimony himself. As I said, I think it defies credulity to act as if that's a realistic prospect. But and then the other piece of it was that there's a lot of information out there publicly. Justice Gorsuch pointed out in his opinion that is not actually the case for this very specific time period at issue between the end of 2002 and fall of 2003, that there's much less in the public record about that time period. And that's really the gap that this discovery was meant to fill. So while in general, I think that's true, I think the showing of need was somewhat greater at least than the justices credited.
So let's turn now to the ruling in Fazaga. Liza, the justices in that case weren't divided like they were in the Zubaydah case. What did they say on the issue of that provision in FISA overriding the state secrets privilege? And what were your reactions to the ruling? You mentioned being surprised by which questions the court decided to answer and which ones they didn't.
I thought the court's opinion in Fazaga was completely incoherent. If the court had held that 1806F applies, you know, only in criminal cases or FISA challenges, and that the state secrets privilege applies in all other cases, I would have disagreed with that reading of the statute, but it would have at least made sense. Instead, the court assumed that 1806F applies, in this case, applied in Fazaga, but held that it doesn't displace the state secrets privilege because the procedures for the two approaches are different. And therefore, I am quoting, nothing about the operation of that provision, 1806F, is at all compatible with the state secrets privilege. Well, yes, the procedures under 1806F are very different from the procedures under the state secrets privilege. That's why the plaintiffs argue that 1806F displaces the privilege rather than arguing that it codifies the privilege. If 1806F did nothing but restate exactly the procedures that apply when the government invokes the state secrets privilege, there would be nothing for the court to decide. The notion that because the procedures are different, the two approaches are not incompatible, it's just head scratching. I mean, the more different they are, the less compatible they are. Remember that the question here is what happens when the government believes that disclosing certain information through litigation would harm national security. 1806F sets out one set of procedures that follow from this. The state secrets privilege sets out another. And these approaches aren't just different, they're conflicting, at least in this case. The former approach would require the court to examine the evidence in camera and rule on the lawfulness of the surveillance, while the state secrets approach would not require an in-camera examination and would not allow a ruling on the lawfulness of the surveillance. I mean, you can prove the incompatibility of these approaches with a simple thought experiment. Suppose you had a case in which the government sought to trigger both 1806F and the state secrets privilege at the same time. What procedures would the court follow exactly? And that's not actually, in this case, a hypothetical, because the state secrets privilege is asserted by the head of the relevant agency, while 1806F is triggered by an affidavit from the attorney general saying that disclosure would harm national security. In this case, the agency is the FBI. So the state secrets privilege was invoked in an affidavit by the attorney general saying that disclosure would harm national security. So in other words, the attorney general's affidavit in this case both invokes the state secrets privilege and on its face triggers the procedures of 1806F. So what on earth is the district court supposed to do on remand? Does it rule on the lawfulness of surveillance as required by 1806F? Or does it dismiss the claim as the government seeks to have it do under the state secrets privilege? Now, in most cases where the relevant agency isn't the Department of Justice, the government is going to resolve this conflict by picking which approach it wants to take. Is it going to submit a declaration from the head of the agency claiming state secrets, or is it going to file an affidavit from the attorney general talking about national security harm? And in a civil lawsuit, it will pick the state secrets privilege every time because it can get the evidence and possibly even the whole lawsuit thrown out without any determination of the lawfulness of surveillance. So in practice, what the court was holding, even though it didn't say so, is that the state secrets privilege displaces 1806F. And that's just not how it's supposed to work. When a statute comes into conflict with the common law, in the hierarchy of legal authorities, the statute should prevail. So I just found the decision to be baffling. It was unanimous, which makes it even more baffling. And yeah, that's where it left me.
Bob, any reactions to the ruling here? Were you surprised at all by it?
I guess surprised it was unanimous and surprised that, I mean, there were so many ways they could have tried to decide the case based on, sometimes the court tries to decide things on more limited grounds, you know, so here they could have decided it based on various ways to construe 1806F, and there were certainly a lot of things, interesting things being debated at argument. And instead, the court went bigger. I mean, it basically, like Liza said, just punted on the meaning of 1806F, saying it doesn't matter because it doesn't displace the state secrets privilege. Basically, the court then just took this as an opportunity to say, not only do we have the state secrets privilege and that we're reaffirming it, but it's such an important doctrine of common law, meaning the courts, you know, made it up, whether it was, you know, read it into the Constitution or just as a matter of common law, that we should assume that it exists and that it applies unless Congress specifically in a clear statement abrogates it. So they completely surprised me here by adopting in a unanimous opinion, a clear statement rule saying that even when Congress is legislating on issues that look exactly like it speak to matters of national security and when to disclose information that is otherwise, you know, protected, that we're not going to assume that the state secrets privilege doesn't apply on top of that. It kind of reminds me of, you know, they argued the EPA case the other day about the greenhouse gas and whether Congress gave authority to the EPA to regulate it as they did. And one of the sides there was raising the so-called major questions doctrine, saying, look, if Congress is going to, you know, deal with that kind of major question, it needs to do so expressly. We, the court, can't just assume it was giving that power to the EPA. And the court was debating that. And so now looking at, after hearing that argument a couple weeks ago, you know, seeing this opinion here, well, they've kind of adopted their own version of that here, that the state secrets doctrine is such a major question, right? It's such an important doctrine to executive power and privilege that you need a clear statement from Congress that they're actually displacing it and providing different rules. And instead, we have now for 1806 this kind of set of parallel rules, which is not entirely clear how it all works together. So to me, what's surprising is how this decision, which I thought was going to be decided in the weeds when we talked back a few months ago, turned out to be an opportunity where the court unanimously embraced the state secrets privilege, reaffirmed it, and adopted this broad state's clear statement principle. So that did take me by quite surprise.
And the clear statement principle, I mean, I guess that makes sense in a situation, and clear statement principles apply in a situation where, you know, where you don't have to resolve some kind of direct conflict, right? So if these privileges could, or sorry, if 1806F and the state secrets privilege, if the procedures that are required under those two different approaches could kind of live harmoniously together, then yeah, sure. The fact that you wouldn't assume without a clear statement that Congress meant to knock the state secrets privilege out of the picture. But when they actually conflict, which they may not do so in every case, but they certainly do here, and they could, let me put it that way. And there are certainly other cases in which they would conflict. Then I don't think that the court does not have the luxury of saying, well, one doesn't displace the other because they conflict. So one has to displace the other. And at that point, the question is which trumps, a statute or the common law? And I think that's been answered in the case law. So it's odd, just really odd.
Liza, when we recorded our earlier podcast about these cases back in October, before the court decided in either of them, you thought that the court taking up the cases suggested that it would reverse the lower court rulings and defer to the executive on matters of state secrets, which is exactly what we saw happen. And you worried then that it might become easier for courts to defer to the state secrets privilege in general after these cases. After seeing how the court ruled in both the cases, do you still think that's the case? Or do you think that the rulings here are narrow enough to avoid that?
I do think that they are narrow enough to avoid that. I mean, they certainly do reinforce significant deference to the executive branch and claims of national security. But I think that that deference was already the common practice. And then the question of what that deference looks like in this case, you know, you have Justice Gorsuch saying, well, it doesn't pass the straight face test. And you have other justices saying, nah, it's plausible. I mean, that feels fact specific enough to this case that it doesn't necessarily have to sort of leak into other cases. I mean, you know, perhaps not surprisingly, the court managed to avoid answering the two most important unresolved questions about the privilege. You know, first, to what extent is the privilege rooted in the president's Article II authority, which they punted in the, at least in the majority of opinions. And second, under what circumstances, if any, can invocation of the privilege result in the dismissal of a lawsuit? And they punted that. They basically punted that as well. Now, you know, the court in Zubaydah did conclude that the lawsuit should be dismissed, but it pointed to the very unusual circumstances of a proceeding under 28 U.S.C. 1782, where the entire lawsuit is a discovery request, so that if all of the evidence sought in discovery is privileged, there really is nothing left of the lawsuit. Now, I agree with Justice Kagan that the court should have remanded to give the plaintiff a chance to amend his discovery request. But in any event, this was in theory closer to a Totten situation than a Reynolds one, namely a situation in which really the entirety of the lawsuit is about privileged information, if you read it the way the majority did.
Bob, same question for you. Has the court made it easier with these two rulings to defer to the executive on state secrets issues, or has it maintained status quo?
I think it's made it easier. I think there was questions. They hadn't heard of state secrets cases in a long time. And you have all these originalists and textualists up there. And there was, there could have been a group of justices who said, look, this is not in the Constitution. And where Congress speaks to these issues directly, we're not, you know, we the court should back off. You know, look what they do in the Bivens cases. Look what they do in other areas where the courts have a common law doctrines. And they're very deferential. Like, well, Congress has spoken to when there should be a cause of action, so we need to back off. And then here, just the opposite, they have now doubled down and re-embraced these common law privileges. And in Fagaza, saying that if Congress wants to displace it, they need to do so, you know, expressly. So it's just sort of like the opposite of the approach they've taken when you're trying to sue government officials, where they read any tea leaves of what Congress is doing as displacing the common law cause of action created by the courts. Here they're saying, look, Congress needs to be expressly clear if it wants to displace the state secrets privilege. And then we have in the Abu Zubaydah case, them, you know, continuing to show strong deference to the executive, even when the information is really largely in the public domain already, and that they're just going to, especially when the government comes and says this is going to harm our relationship with another country's intelligence servants or another country's military, they're just not going to feel capable of second guessing that, even when the facts staring them right in the face might suggest that it's a paper thin explanation. So even though we have a few voices of Sotomayor and Gorsuch, that's only two out of nine. So I think this really does both, you know, reaffirms the state secrets doctrine, reestablishes it, re-entrenches it, and with the clear statement principle, you know, shows that it's probably stronger than ever.
Yeah, Bob's right. I mean, I was really, my fear with these cases was that we were going to get a holding that the privilege is constitutionally based, therefore it can't really be regulated in any way by Congress, and that we might get a ruling on the appropriateness of a ruling that sort of collapsed the Totten and Reynolds versions of the privilege in the way that the government has and some courts have been doing. That was my fear. I was grateful that that did not happen. And so that's really what I was responding to. But yeah, I mean, Bob's right that the deference calculus, the way that it played out in Zubaydah, that's too much deference. It is, I think, the first time that the Supreme Court has said that information that's in the public domain may nonetheless be protected by the state secrets privilege. And you know, that can do a lot of mischief. that principle. And on the clear statement rule, I guess that's problematic. I guess I find the holding of Fazaga to be so bizarre that it's hard for me to imagine how it could be replicated in a different case with different circumstances. But yeah, I mean, Bob makes a really good point.
I think that's a great place to end. Bob and Liza, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Hamza Shittu of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare Material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and look out for other podcasts, including The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. As always, thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.